before we turn to this extraordinary text of the Beatitudes, let's note two things about where we are in the liturgy. First of all, we are between the great feast of Corpus Christi and the great feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, or the two feasts, the hearts of Jesus and Mary. So that's a beautiful place to be. On one hand, the Eucharist we celebrated yesterday, and on the other hand, the heart of Jesus, they're the same, but two different ways to approach the same mystery of the love of God given to us, revealed to us. Today's psalm might help us understand this. Taste and see the goodness of the Lord. We taste with the Eucharist, we see the Sacred Heart. You can see they're both experiences of the Lord's goodness, meaning his merciful love. So that's one thing, where we are in the liturgy, we're between these two great solemnities. The other thing is that we begin now, in the daily Gospels, we begin to read from Matthew, starting with Matthew chapter 5, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. So this is a change, it's like changing gears. We were reading from the Gospel of Mark all these weeks, now we're reading from Gospel of Matthew. Okay, we start with this. I say this is an extraordinary text. The Beatitudes have had an extraordinary impact on the church and on the world. They're just incalculable in their force. They become very familiar to us, so perhaps we don't think of it this way, but the Beatitudes represent a completely different way of thinking, radically different. And there are many ways to describe this, and since we've studied the Beatitudes in the community a number of times, I can't remember who said what, but I know that somewhere it says that the Beatitudes are like a self-portrait of Jesus. Maybe that's in the Catechism, or maybe it's Pope Benedict who said that, or maybe both, I can't remember. But the Beatitudes are a self-portrait. Jesus, in describing who's blessed, is describing himself. He's poor in spirit. He is mourns. He's the one who's meek, who hungers and thirsts for righteousness, certainly persecuted. So he was poor in birth, he's even poorer in his death. Persecuted in his birth, even more persecuted in his death, and every time in between. So Jesus, this is a revelation not only of how we are to live, of the inner spirit of our life, but of Jesus himself. We're his followers, after all. The Beatitudes have also been described as the Magna Carta of the Anawim. We who are following Anawim spirituality are not surprised to hear this. This sets forth the fundamental principles of what it means to be poor, poor in spirit, the Anawim. In fact, if you look in many Bibles, if you look at the footnotes, there'll be something here. Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, that will mention the Anawim, or the spirit of the Anawim. Just last week, we were studying one of the talks of Pope Francis, and he described the Beatitudes as a kind of arch, an entryway, a decorated entryway into the profound Sermon on the Mount, the heart of which is the Lord's Prayer. That's where we're headed in his series of talks. But he says, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, it starts with the Beatitudes, and that is in itself a revolution. The Beatitudes are a revolutionary text. I remember explaining in that talk last Thursday, he's not talking about political revolution. He's talking about an even deeper revolution, an overturning of the whole way of thinking, of the whole set of priorities, an overturning of the very standards on which most people live most of the time. This is the Beatitudes. It's revolution. And he says, well, the gospel is proclaimed, it's revolutionary. It pushes us forward in a new way. It is a revolution. I mean, let's face it. When someone believes and lives that it's blessed to be poor in spirit, he's not following, he's not playing by the same rules. So Christians walk into the world and say, you can't intimidate me. You can't entice me. You can't threaten me, because mine or ours is the kingdom of heaven. If you persecute me, I'll rejoice. If you insult me, I'll welcome it. That's the Christian response. So it's not that Christians go into the world and say, overcome you by being greater or being holier or being better. We're not going to dominate you. We're not even playing by the same rules. We're not even playing the same game you're playing. That's the revolution here. The Beatitudes set a completely different set of rules. A very freeing set of rules, principles of life, but also very challenging, because to live poor in spirit with confidence in the kingdom of heaven is to be detached from what makes us rich. It's to be willing to be stripped of everything that makes us rich and powerful and famous, comfortable. So that's why we can say we're blessed to be poor in spirit, blessed to be mourning, to be meek, hungering, merciful, clean of heart, peacemakers. It's a very hopeful Magna Carta. It's a hopeful set of principles, because it says no matter what we might be experiencing now, no matter how bad it may be now, we will be consoled. We will be comforted. We will inherit the land. We'll be satisfied. No matter how hungry we are now, hunger for truth, for righteousness, for a better world, and for better treatment of the poor, and for a lot of things that we hunger for, we will be satisfied. We know it. We don't know when or how. Maybe we'll experience some glimpse of it in this life, but for sure in the next, we will rejoice at the justice of God and the victory of God. We are willing to be peacemakers, meaning we're not out to crush our opponents all the time. We're willing to work out peaceful solutions because we're children of God. We're not children of this world. So that's the revolution that Pope Francis speaks out, and that's the revolution of the Beatitudes. We can see it if we're formed by these principles. We can see it everywhere in the Scriptures, especially in the Gospels and in the whole New Testament. Especially, see how different people who follow these principles are, how different their way of life is, and how the world is bewildered by people who live like this. Probably no one pays too much attention to the Office of Readings, but we who were earlier this morning read the Office of Readings, we read a passage from St. Ignatius of Antioch, that famous passage where he says, I want to be ground up like wheat so I can become holy bread. I want the beasts in the Colosseum to grind me up with their teeth. They say, what is this man talking about? He's crazy? No, he's following these principles that he's not attached to his life in this world. He's not attached to comfort. He's not attached to his own body. He only wants the kingdom of God. This Ignatius of Antioch is one of the early voices that highlights the difference between Christian way of thinking and the world's way of thinking. He says, I don't get in the way of the beasts. Don't stop them from chewing me up. he deliberately says it in a provocative way. But the principle is the same as we get in today's gospel. We are blessed if we are persecuted, because our reward will be great in heaven, and that reward is our incentive even now. Okay, in today's first reading, we begin reading Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, and he is speaking from this same foundation. The word that stands out in this first reading, if you looked at it, you probably noticed it. The word that really stands out is encouragement. He says it about a dozen times. Encouragement, the God of all encouragement, who encourages us in our every affliction, so that we may be able to encourage those who are in any affliction with the encouragement with which we ourselves are encouraged by God. He keeps saying it over and over again, encouragement, encouragement, encouragement. In the older translation we used to use, it wasn't so glaring, because there were different words. He comforts us, he gives us consolation. But in this translation, it's encouragement. Now, I don't know the Greek word here. It would be nice to know the fuller meaning of what he's talking about. But if we look at this passage, we will see right away, he's not talking about being freed from all suffering. He's not talking about a comfortable life. He's talking about a gift that makes it possible for us to persevere in suffering. So that's why it's an example of what we learned from the Beatitudes, a completely different set of rules. According to the world's rules, in order to be happy, we have to have no suffering. And if we're suffering, what we need is freedom from suffering. That's the rule. If we're suffering, that's bad. Paul says, as Christ's sufferings overflow to us. Well, that doesn't sound very good, to have Christ's sufferings overflowing on us. It sounds like we're being drowned in his sufferings. As Christ's sufferings overflow to us, so through Christ does our encouragement also overflow. So instead of backing off from suffering and insisting that it end so that we can be happy, he says, no, the more suffering we have, the more encouragement we have overflowing so that we can persevere. He's taking us to a completely different level, or as I said earlier, he's playing by a completely different set of rules. A set of rules that doesn't make any sense in the world. He says, well, if we are afflicted, well, we're suffering, it is for your encouragement. Well, what good is that to us? If I'm suffering and you get the benefit, well, what good is that? According to the world, that's a bad deal. But to those who follow the Beatitudes, say, wait a minute, I've become an instrument for blessing for others. It is for your encouragement and salvation. And if we are encouraged, which we are in all our sufferings, if we have this gift, this strengthening grace that makes it possible for us to persevere and even grow in suffering, it is for your encouragement. If we are encouraged, it's for your encouragement. So the Christian mindset is, it's a win-win situation. If I suffer, God uses it for good. If I'm encouraged, God uses it for good. If I get the benefit, other people get the benefit. If I don't get the benefit, other people get the benefit. You can't lose. As long as we submit ourselves to this revolution of values and of priorities. If we are encouraged, it is for your encouragement, which enables you to endure the same sufferings that we suffer. Well, Who wants to endure the sufferings of anybody else? That breaks the rules of the world. We don't want to suffer. Paul says, no, don't be so insistent that you not suffer. Put your trust in this gift of God that makes it possible not only to suffer and persevere, but even to benefit from it. It's a radical way of thinking. Our hope for you is firm. He's talking to the Corinthians. They have enough troubles, as he knows. Our hope for you is firm, not because they're so holy or they're so good or strong. Our hope for you is firm, for we know that as you share in the sufferings, you also share in the encouragement. So he's not saying you're not going to have any more suffering. That's not the Christian message. We are going to have suffering. Everybody does. Whether we submit to it or not, everybody is going to suffer. That's life in this fallen world. The Christians know that God is at work in these contradictory experiences. He's even doing something good in what looks so bad. So taste and see the goodness of the Lord. Taste and see the goodness of the Lord. See that his heart, pierced, wounded, suffering, is overflowing with encouragement for us. Beautiful message, challenging message, very good for us as we celebrate Corpus Christi and as we look forward to honoring the Sacred Heart of Jesus.